This is 1A. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, in for Joshua Johnson. Thanks for spending the hour with us today. Lynching is back in America's headlines. That's how a recent op-ed in The Guardian put it, referring to the killing of Richard Collins III, a black college student and newly commissioned Army lieutenant who was stabbed to death last week on the campus of the University of Maryland. Sean Urbanski was charged with killing Collins, and he was a member of a white supremacist Facebook group called Alt-Reich Nation. The police and FBI are investigating, but so far have declined to call the fatal stabbing a hate crime. The killing has echoes of past racial crimes, though, and it has many Americans asking, how does this still happen in 2017? In a few minutes, we'll speak with historian and National Book Award winner Ibram X. Kendi, who looks at the nation's violent and racist past for answers about our present. But first, let's speak with Bracton Booker. He's a reporter here in the newsroom at WAMU, and he's been covering the Richard Collins story. Bracton, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So first, tell us what happened last Saturday at the University of Maryland.
So Richard Collins III, a black student who attended Bowie State University in Maryland, he was visiting friends on University of Maryland's campus, which is not far. It's about a 20-minute drive from Bowie State. He was visiting friends there, and in the wee hours of Saturday morning, as he was awaiting his Uber, he was approached by a guy. Some words were exchanged. And next thing that we know, he ended up allegedly stabbed by the gentleman you mentioned in the intro, Sean Urbanski.
All right. Well, we know that Sean Urbanski is part of this alt-right racist hate group online, at least. Why have authorities not called the fatal stabbing a hate crime?
Well, look, I think it's really difficult to prove a hate crime, right? The FBI is now involved with the local authorities in the investigation. They are still reviewing video evidence on campus. And just because someone is a member of a Facebook group does not necessarily mean that they are, you know, necessarily a white supremacist and that they are going to then commit murder, right? So there are still lots of things that investigators need to find out, and that is why it has not been officially labeled as a hate crime just yet.
All right. Richard Collins III's father spoke with NBC News earlier this week, and I want to play a brief clip from that interview.
You know, we always, his mother and I used to talk about him. He's just going to be the life of the party wherever he goes. You know, he was easy to get along with. He was a competitor. He loved lacrosse and soccer. You know, he was a runner. Oh, he prided himself on his time and his ROTC unit being the top runner in his PTs and physical training, that is. He was just competitive at heart, you know, and had a loving and giving heart. You know, he'd go out of his way, sometime to my chagrin, to try and help others, you know.
All right. So instead of just focusing on his death, let's talk a bit about his life. Tell us some more that you found out in your reporting about Richard Collins III.
Yes. Yeah, so I found out quite a bit about Richard Collins III when I visited Bowie State University's campus on Monday, when the news really started trickling out about his death. And almost to a person, people said that this guy was like outgoing, brilliant, a very, very smart individual. As we alluded to, he had just been commissioned a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. He had completed his training at in the ROTC at Bowie State, and he also had a lighter side. He would refer to himself as Mr. Handsome and Wealthy because his name was Richard. So rich, he said, like, I'm going to be rich once I'm done with this, right? So he was almost to a person, even to the shuttle bus driver who would drop him off at some of his training at a nearby Fort Meade, said that, you know, he didn't know him well, but he came to the vigil on Monday night because he said this guy was so respectful, so humble. And every time he would get off the shuttle bus, he would say, thank you. Thank you for dropping me off.
Well, he certainly in his photographs had a real presence about him and charisma from what's come through in the interviews with his friends and family. He should have walked across the stage in a cap and gown on Tuesday. Instead, his gown was draped really dramatically over an empty front row chair at Bowie State University's graduation. You were there. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, I will say that was a difficult atmosphere, right? Certainly, you wanted to pay tribute, and there was a moment of silence held for him, and he was the first name called when they were awarding degrees. But on the other hand, a graduation is a celebratory mood, right? They had 650 other students that were, you know, finished their collegiate career and were being awarded degrees.
And it's so, a historically black college.
Yes, absolutely. Bowie State is Maryland's oldest black, predominantly black university. So, I mean, this is really a time, particularly for black students, to like really cherish and say, hey, you've really worked hard to get your degree. So certainly there was a balance that the university officials had to play. But yes, that was a very dramatic moment when the chair with Second Lieutenant Collins' robe was on the chair and it flashed on the Jumbotron. You could hear gasps in the audience because people were so taken aback by it.
I know that Sean Urbanski has been charged with first and second degree murder as well as first degree assault. But while investigators are collecting evidence and trying to determine whether he should also be charged with a hate crime on top of that, Richard Collins III's family and friends are left with all these unanswered questions, and not just the pain of his murder, but the pain of wondering why. Where are they going from here? You've talked to them.
Yes. So just before we get to how the Collins family is coping with this, let me first mention that Sean Urbanski made his first court appearance this week. He's being held without bond. His next court appearance is next month, I believe June 15th. And lawyers for Urbanski said that he was intoxicated and incoherent at the time of the incident. Now, prosecutors are also saying like this was unprovoked. They didn't know each other, and this is all pretty random.
Tell us a bit about him. Was he a student? Did he have a job?
Yes, he was a student at University of Maryland. I'm not sure about his work history, but he definitely was a student at University of Maryland. And from what people have said, I have not done the reporting myself, but they said that he had shown some signs of, you know, that he had some connections with some of these alt-right groups pretty early on in his collegiate career. But, I mean, again, this is not to say that because he is associating with some of these fringe groups that he is then going to commit murder. Right?
For that reason. Although the police seem to believe that he did commit murder, whether it was for that reason or some other reason.
Yes.
All right. So it's been widely reported, as you say, that Urbanski was part of this racist Facebook group called Alt-Reich Nation. NPR reported a couple weeks ago on the unprecedented spike in white supremacist activity on college campuses across the U.S. since the election of Donald Trump. What have you observed in your reporting?
Well, just regionally, and my colleague Patrick Madden had a very interesting and moving piece today about regionally in the Washington, D.C. area that campuses have, both nationally and again in this region, seen an uptick of hate speech and flyers of that nature that have been trying to lure or recruit students to these fringe groups. You've seen incidents on American University's campus in Washington, D.C., where you've had nooses, hanging bananas being strung up across campus with the letters AKA on them, which refers to Alpha Kappa Alpha, predominantly black sorority. And those were being hung up on the same day that the university's first black female president was to take office.
So nooses, bananas, and all on the day of a black female
president. Yes, this is at American University. There were also
right
incidents at University of Maryland that had nooses at a fraternity house. So you've seen these types of things happen, and really the Anti-Defamation League, which monitors these kind of hate incidents, has said that they've seen an uptick of this since the presidential election. So we are certainly seeing it here, and people are asking the question, like, why is this happening? And we're trying to get to the bottom of that.
The Anti-Defamation League, also the Southern Poverty Law Center, Absolutely. Have both reported on an uptick. Have either of them, in the 30 seconds we have left, given any tips or suggestions to authorities of what should be done about this?
Well, look, we're kind of in uncharted territory. I think University of Maryland and American University have been praised on how they are handling this on their campus. Like, certainly universities want to project that this is a safe space for all students, but particularly students of color, because they are trying to get more minority students into their university. And they certainly want to show that, hey, this is a safe space. But universities also have to show that they can protect students when these kinds of incidents arise.
That's Bracton Booker, a reporter with WAMU here in Washington. Bracton, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, historian Ibram X. Kendi joins us to talk about the history of race and racism in America. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. Stay with us. This is 1A. I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Last year, at the age of 34, historian Ibram X. Kendi won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. His provocative work, stamped from the beginning the definitive history of racist ideas in America, traces the long history of racist thought in the U.S. and examines how it has been used to enforce discrimination to this day. Kendi is currently professor of African American history at the University of Florida, but in August he'll move next door to us at American University as founding director and professor at the new Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at the university. Ibram X. Kendi joins us today from Gainesville, Florida. Ibram, great to have you on 1A.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And of course, we would love to hear from you listeners too. Share with us your thoughts or your questions for Professor Kendi. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A, or you can email us 1A@WAMU.org. So, Ibram, I'm wondering first if you have any response to what we've just been discussing, the killing of Richard Collins III a few days ago.
Well, personally, you know, I'm extremely sad, and how could I not be angry? You know, I'm a product of an HBCU, and really, whenever I think of what Collins' friends are feeling, whenever I think of what his family must be feeling, you know, I get even sadder. But as a scholar and a historian of racism, I'm actually not surprised, and I'm not shocked, and I'm not even asking questions like, how could this happen in 2017? You know, this unfortunately is entirely normal for 2017. It's really an emblematic of the historic progression of racism that I chronicle in my work. And we need to realize that one of the greatest threats to American lives today, if not the greatest threat, are white supremacists who are armed and angry and who, from their standpoint, are seeking to make America great again.
You know, you said you yourself are the product of an HBCU, meaning historically black college and university, like Richard Collins was about to graduate from. A number of the headlines and commentators have dubbed this a lynching, the lynching of Richard Collins. And the word, of course, is incredibly loaded, and it's coming up again and again in the news. Last week, a Mississippi state representative called for the lynching of politicians who support the dismantling of Confederate monuments in neighboring Louisiana. On Monday, Congressman Al Green, who is black, confirmed that officials are investigating threats of lynching that he has received since he called for President Trump's impeachment. So unpack for us this term lynching in the context of 2017.
So I think if we first, of course, have to define what a lynching is, or to a certain extent what a lynching was. And typically, black people were lynched for two reasons. Either they defied sort of the racial order or racial codes of the day, or they were uplifting themselves. And so in the case of Richard Collins, you know, there are reports that the alleged killer told him to move and Richard said no. You know, and there's, of course, a long history of black people being told to move off the sidewalk, because, of course, whites are supposed to have the right of way. And then, of course, Richard Collins was uplifting himself. I mean, he was, you know, as the reporter talked about, he was a great student. He was seeking to uplift himself. And these are the types of people who have historically been lynched, people who challenged racism directly, or they challenged racism through their own uplift.
And the term, which we sometimes hear used very negatively, is uppity, that, you know, people who are sort of stepping out of what whites perceive to be the proper place for blacks. Is that what you're getting at partly here?
Precisely. The proper place for black people 100 years ago was to be landless, was to be poor, was to be uneducated, was to be easily exploitable. And so those who seek to acquire land and education and those who seek to strive were perceived to be uppity. But the irony is that at the same time these people were said through racist ideas to be lazy, when they were industrious, they were looked down upon too. And so no matter what black people did, when they were looked upon as lazy, it was a confirmation of racist ideas. And when they strove, they typically were on the back end of lynching type violence.
All right. Well, yesterday on this show, we were discussing the fight against global extremism in the wake of the Manchester, England attack. And we got a number of listener comments similar to a tweet sent to us from Richard Bottoms, which read, "A black United States Army officer is stabbed to death by a white supremacist, but ISIS is who I should be worried about." What's your reaction to that?
I think he's exactly correct. I mean, when we look at the actual data, in terms of the number of Americans who've been killed by terrorists, when we look at the number of Facebook groups that are being organized and the number of people who are being led to white supremacist Facebook groups, it's far outreaching ISIS in the United States. When we look at the number of people who are arming themselves and for what reason in this country, I think his analysis is entirely accurate.
You know, in that same conversation, we had Georgetown University professor Christine Fair on, and she's someone who's been in the headlines recently for a confrontation she had with the white nationalist Richard Spencer at the Alexandria, Virginia gym where they both go. The Spencer story came up in our conversation. Have a listen.
Now, he is your cleaned up Nazi. You know, it looks like he dresses at American Eagle. He doesn't use profanity. And what he does is that he relies upon a really vicious, dumb but sophisticated army of violent trolls. And so while Richard Spencer was making a video decrying how he can't go lift with the bros in Old Town, and he's looking for a new gym, Mr. Collins' family is actually looking for a funeral home. So I think that this is something that in the United States, all of us that work on terrorism should really be thinking, what makes a white man decide he's going to stab a person just because he's black? His killer didn't see that he was an accomplished member of the U.S. Army and that he was airborne qualified. He just saw his skin.
What's your reaction to that?
I think that she's certainly onto something. And I guess from the standpoint that in my work, I try to distinguish between the producers of racist ideas, people like Spencer, and the consumers of racist ideas, like presumably the man who killed Richard Collins. And we have these people who are consuming these racist ideas and being led to believe that there are a series of problem people in this country. And those problem people are Black, those problem people are Muslim, those problem people are Latinos, women, and on and on. And instead of realizing that what's actually causing the problems for those people are the policies that those very people who are convincing them that they're problem people, and I think we have to recognize, you know, this very powerful wave of the production of racist ideas. And we need to really think very clearly about these people who are consuming them and really on some level show a level of empathy to understand that in certain ways they are victims of racist ideas too.
You know, we have a number of comments coming in along these lines. Ephraim emails us, racism never ended in the U.S. It has remained active but underground, with its ugly head surfacing to the general public from time to time. And Porter Woman tweets us, is racial violence getting worse, or are we all more aware of it because of mass media and social media? More aware would be a good thing. What is your reaction to that?
I think we are more aware of it precisely because of social media. But I think I also agree with the first comment that racism did not go away. You know, I sort of chronicle not just racial progress, but as I stated earlier, the progression of racism, this sort of dual history in which we, of course, can be able to see the ways in which Barack Obama or even an Oprah or other people are emblematic of the progress that Black people have made, a specific segment of Black America. But we should simultaneously recognize the progression of racism. And the only way that racism will be over in this country is if racial inequality and racial disparities are no more. And there's only really two causes of racial disparities and inequities. Either there's something wrong and inferior about Black people, or racial discrimination. And what racist ideas lead us to think is that there's something wrong with Black people. And then it prevents us from seeing the racial discrimination that's all around us.
I want to talk about your national award-winning book, Stamped from the Beginning. It narrates essentially the entire history of racist ideas here in America, and you examine how and why those ideas took root. But your argument and your retelling of it is really a surprising one. As the Washington Post put it, you highlight the unending and unwitting racism of the well-meaning. We're talking Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Barack Obama. Explain to us what you mean here.
So I specifically wanted to write a book on racist ideas. And I defined a racist idea as any idea suggesting that Black people are inferior, or I should say a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. And I chronicle two types of racist ideas. One type that I call segregationist ideas, which suggests Black people are inferior by nature. Black people are permanently inferior. Racial inequality is permanent. And then a second type of racist idea that I name an assimilationist idea. And these are typically the ideas of the well-meaning. Typically, assimilationist ideas suggest that Black people are inferior by nurture due to their environment. And they challenge segregationist ideas, who typically are white supremacists. And they say, no, you know, Black people can be civilized. Black people can be developed. And they engage in a series of programs and projects to do so. But they still believe that Black people are inferior right now, which is why I classify them as racist ideas.
All right. You know, you do make this distinction, which you mentioned a few minutes ago, between the influential producers of racist ideas and the consumers of racist ideas. And you say that the consumers are the victims, too. Explain that a little more for us.
Well, again, if I chronicle how really racist ideas come out of a need to defend racist policies. racially discriminatory policies, specifically policies that benefit people. And so if people are benefiting from these racist policies, and there's only two causes of them, discrimination or black inferiority, then they're going to produce racist ideas, convince people, including white people, even including black people, including all people, that it's the cause of these inequalities are black inferiority. And so then people are led to believe that the problems are people as opposed to policies. They're led to believe that, and then they take it out on those very people as opposed to organizing with anti-racists to challenge racial discrimination.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to 1A. You write in your book that time and again, racist ideas have not been born and bred in the cradle of ignorant, hateful, or unpatriotic minds. Rather, quote, powerful and brilliant men and women have produced racist ideas in order to justify racist policies of their era. What do you see as the principal function of racist ideas in American history?
Well, I consider the principal function of racist ideas to quell or reduce resistance to racial discrimination. And I see this over and over again, new racist ideas being created to prevent us from seeing that the real problem in our society is racial discrimination. And I mean, we see, for instance, now that, you know, you have people making the case that there's a voter fraud problem, which is a very long history of calling black voters in particular fraudulent and corrupt. And that, therefore, becomes the justification of voter ID laws that disenfranchise not only black voters, but senior citizen voters and students and a series of other voters. And when we educate or try to persuade or show these people that actually there's, you know, studies show that voter fraud is actually not a problem, they only say that it's even worse than I originally thought, right? Because they weren't creating those ideas out of ignorance. They were creating them to justify policies that benefited them.
I want to play a voicemail now that was left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Ron. I'm calling from Michigan. In 2009, shortly after the election of President Obama, I was working at a sportsman show in Ohio. I came upon a booth and witnessed a group of white adults with their white children, the children holding guns, and being encouraged to shoot at a picture of President Obama's head that was mounted on the wall. This was done openly, it was done cheerfully, and the children were participating willingly. So you want to know where homegrown terrorism comes from, we just have to look no further than our own backyards. It was the most disgusting thing I'd ever seen, and when I share the story with people, they don't want to believe it, but I assure you, I saw this with my own eyes. Thank you.
So, Ibram, some of this sounds almost as if, you know, I've heard the argument that we are a nation that is generally speaking in the forward motion of racial progress, but that there is backlash and that the election of President Obama did spark a backlash among racists. Do you buy into that idea?
So I believe that we are a nation in the forward march of racial progress, but I've shown through my work that we're also a nation in the forward march of racist progress. And that racist progress was, I think, emblematic of this series of attacks upon voters after Obama's election, or more importantly, the voter ID laws that I just mentioned. And I think, you know, what that caller described, I think, was extremely gruesome. But we have to ask the question, what led them to believe that Barack Obama is such a problem that they need to train their kids to shoot him? Like, what type of ideas and who created these ideas and for what purpose?
One more thought shared by a listener here. Wendell tweets us, "It is truly a damn shame that we are still having to deal with such ignorant outbursts of racism in 2017. And Danny emails us, news media reports on a group considered white supremacists as a group that exhibits defamatory behavior towards a minority. In principle, how does this differ from a group considered LGBT or minority calling any group opposed to them bigots, homophobes, etc.? So hold that thought. We will talk about that when we come back from our break. Coming up, more of your thoughts and your questions for historian Ibram X. Kendi. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is 1A. Stay with us. This is 1A. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're talking about race and racism in America with University of Florida professor Ibram X. Kendi. He's the author of the National Book Award winning Stamped from the Beginning. There's still time to get in your thoughts and questions for Professor Kendi. You can email us at 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Ibram, right before the break, I was reading you an email from Danny, who said that the news media reports on groups considered white supremacists as groups that exhibit defamatory behavior towards a minority. And he asks, in principle, how does this differ from a group considered LGBT or minority calling any group that opposes them bigots, homophobes, racists, etc.?
Well, I think I think one of the reasons why I wrote Stamped from the Beginning was so we can have a clear definition of racism, or more specifically of a racist idea. And a racist idea suggests racial hierarchy. And many of these white supremacists, all of these white supremacist groups, consider white people to be superior. That's one of their founding ideological principles. In contrast, you have many groups, LGBT groups, black groups, Latino groups, who philosophically are based on notions of equality. There's a difference between the philosophy of equality and the philosophy of hierarchy. And any group that's based on the philosophy of the hierarchy between groups, whether that's racial groups, gendered groups, sexual groups, ethnic groups, any sort of group, that's bigotry. And any organization based on the equality of groups, whether racial, gender, and so forth, that's anti-bigotry, or in my work, anti-racism.
Well, this is a related question. Aaron emails us, I'm so tired of racism being spoken about as a black and white issue. What about racism against Asians, Hispanics, and Native Americans? It sounds like you're saying that all falls into the bigotry category.
Precisely. And, you know, I certainly in writing my, you know, I study anti-black racism, but there are many scholars in the United States and around the world who, of course, study anti-Asian bigotry, anti-Latino, anti-Chicana racism, and so on and so forth. And certainly all of these are forms of racism.
All right. Well, let me ask you, I want to play another message from our voicemail. This one focused on the threat of domestic terrorism.
Hi, this is Tia from Champaign, Illinois, and I actually just took a class on terrorism. And my final paper was actually about how domestic terrorism by right-wing extremists are actually a lot more of a threat to national security in the United States than Islamic extremism. And this was proven by many studies done by federal enforcement agents ranging from the FBI to local sheriffs. And I think it was about 70% of them agreed that right-wing extremists, which include right-wing nationalists or sovereign citizens, that they consider them much more of a threat than Islamic extremists. So my question is, why is there not more of an effort or even publicity to address these issues versus the 6 terrorism attacks that we may have over the next couple of years?
All right, Ibram, she makes a point. Why is there not more attention paid to the Timothy McVeighs of the world and the Dylan Roofs of the world, who statistically appear to actually be responsible for taking more lives than foreign-born terrorists in this country?
Well, I think because to a certain extent, some of these people, if not most of these people, are the base of one of the major political parties. I think on another level, some people in the Democratic Party feel that they should be seeking to attract these people. And so you have to a certain extent, possibly two major political parties who do not want to alienate these very people. And so I think that's one major reason that we don't talk about, that I think we need to talk about. I think another reason is, even when we think of things like drunk driving, studies show that the majority of drunk drivers in this country are white males. However, communities that have white males driving around are not considered to be dangerous or as dangerous as black communities, even though on certain years you have more people dying from drunk drivers than homicides, you know. And so I think, I guess what I'm trying to say in a nutshell is white men are somehow not considered to be dangerous in the way black people are, in the way Islamic Muslim people are, and the way other people are. And I think that's one of the, also one of the reasons.
Well, one of our listeners, Terry, emails us making a very related point, saying most white Americans have no awareness of race, as white is considered normal and the standard to which all others are compared. It's shocking for white Americans to begin a true understanding of how their feelings of what is normal have devastated communities of color. It's painful, and it's in their best interest not to do this difficult work.
Well, I think it certainly is the case that white has become the standard, and that's certainly the position of both assimilationist and segregationist ideas. But I also think that it is actually not in the best interest of white Americans to not be involved in supporting a campaign against this type of terror that we're talking about. Because even during the lynching era, there were white people who were lynched. We've, of course, been talking over the last few years about black people who've been killed by police. Well, white people have been killed by police. There have been white people who have been subjected to terror from white supremacists. I mean, all throughout the country, you have Jewish centers that are being subjected to attacks from white supremacists. And so I think you have Catholics as well. I mean, so this is not just necessarily black people are not the only people, or people of color are not the only people that's affected by white supremacist terror. White people are too.
Well, you know, one of our listeners, Rita, makes a similar point. She emails us, "I wish we could get off these, quote, race categories. There is only one race, and that is the human race. We just come in many colors. God forbid the earth experiences a pandemic. It will not select who lives or who dies by their race." Interesting point, Rita. All right, Ibram, I want to talk about a really fascinating project you did for the New York Times back in February called A History of Race and Racism in America in 24 Chapters. You selected what you judge to be the most influential books on race and the black experience published in the U.S. for each decade of the nation's existence. You write that these books inspired and sometimes ended the fiercest debates of their times, debates over slavery, segregation, mass incarceration. So I want to go rapid fire through one book from each century to sort of keep it, you know, lightning round style. And you explain to us its significance to American history and our present day. So first, for the 18th century, I've chosen Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral by Phyllis Wheatley from 1773. Why did you pick this?
Well, I picked that because there were so many people across the Western world who were making the case that black people were not capable of writing, black people were not capable of intelligence, black people were not capable of poetry, and they're only capable of being enslaved. And so clearly Phyllis Wheatley's poems challenged that very idea and continues to challenge that idea today among those people who make the case that black people are in some ways intellectually inferior.
All right. And she was, of course, an African-American woman. And you write about how her poetry was proof that what some people had called an uncultivated barbarian could actually be civilized. It's I'm going to have to pick up that book because that was fascinating. All right. Tell us about From the 19th Century, Principles of Biology by Herbert Spencer from 1864. Isn't that the book where we got the term survival of the fittest?
Yes, it is. And of course, many people are familiar with Charles Darwin and social Darwinism. But what we're not as familiar with is that Herbert Spencer really became the principal voice, the principal promoter of social Darwinism in the Western world. I mean, he was beloved by elite Americans who used this notion of survival of the fittest to make the case that those who were rich and white and male were by nature superior. They had evolved. They were the fittest. And so therefore, trying to create social programs that help women, that help poor people, that help black people are a waste of time because they are the unfit.
All right. For the 20th century, Margaret Mitchell's 1936 much beloved classic of the last generation, Gone with the Wind. Let it rip. Tell us why.
So first and foremost, I mean, that may be the most read and most popular book of the 20th century.
Really?
We're, of course, familiar with the film. But even the book itself was widely embraced and widely read, and still I'm sure is being read today. And it made this case that many people still make today, many of the people who are defending these Confederate monuments, that slavery was not as bad as we think it was, that black people were naturally docile, that you had fathers for masters who were paternal and looked after these docile people who enjoyed their enslavement.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to 1A. All right, last one. What you chose for the 21st century was The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander from 2010. Tell us why.
So again, I think most people are familiar with the massive amounts of disparities within the criminal justice system, the mass incarceration of black and brown bodies. But then the question becomes, why is this the case? Why do we have this disparity? Why are 40% of the incarcerated population in this country black, even though they represent only 13% of the national population? And it's either because there's something wrong with black people. Black people commit more crimes. Black people are more violent. Black people are more immoral. Or there's racial discrimination up and down the criminal justice system. And that latter argument is the argument that Michelle Alexander put forth in The New Jim Crow. And it was one of the sort of sparks that lit the fire that later became Black Lives Matter.
All right. So this book, The New Jim Crow, as you say, sparked the fire of Black Lives Matter. One of our listeners, Adam, has a very different view of Black Lives Matter, perhaps, than you. Adam writes, Obama set this country back 60 years with race relations. Black Lives Matter flourished under Obama with its hate speech, including anti-cop rhetoric. They now even ban white people from their events. Attorney General Jeff Sessions needs to stand on the oxygen tube of this hate group. What do you say to that?
Well, first, I wasn't familiar that Black Lives Matter banned white people from their events. But again, it's based on how we define hate, and what we define as anti-cop. I mean, Black Lives Matter activists, for the most part, have said there are these mass disparities in the number of people who are being killed by the police. And, you know, from 2010 to, I think, 2012, FBI statistics stated that young black males were 22 times more likely to be killed by police than young white males. So, again, there's only two causes of that. Either these young black males are acting recklessly with the police, or the police are acting recklessly with these young black males. And the Black Lives Matter has made the case that, no, the racial groups are equal. There's nothing wrong with these young black males, so it must be racial discrimination. There must be something going on with these police officers. But even in a larger sense, there must be something wrong with the criminal justice system that we need to change.
All right. I want to ask about your forthcoming endeavor here in Washington. You're going to be the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University, a university, I should add, that is no stranger to racist incidents of its own.
The FBI is now investigating a racial incident at American University as a hate crime. Several bananas were found hung up in the style of nooses, dangling in three separate locations on the Washington, D.C. campus. This comes just weeks after the university elected its first black female student government president.
All right, this happened just this month. Ibram, what will your Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center do about incidents like this?
Well, I think first we should... I think this center will seek to try to get at the heart of the matter, try to eliminate the policies that are really breeding these ideas, that cause people to want to hang nooses and put up bananas and even take the life of somebody as dear to us as Richard Collins. And so I, you know, I'm seeking to organize a center that's really going to focus on uncovering racial inequality and uncovering the racist policies that are creating them, and seeking to propose policy solutions, different type of policies that will actually create equality. Because again, you know, I write in Stamp from the beginning that really the cradle of these racist ideas that are causing people to engage in these attacks are racial inequalities, are racist policies. And so I think we should really be seeking to pull out these roots so they won't continue to weed over the lives of black people in this country and other groups of people.
All right. Well, with the short time we have left in 1 minute, it may be an oversimplified final question, but is racial unity even possible? Can we eliminate racial inequality in this country?
Without question, I think we can. And I believe that at more of a philosophical level, because really you have to believe change is possible in order to bring it about. And there was a time in the world in which we did not have conceptions of races. We did not have racism. And racism itself emerged, you know, during slavery. And so I think if there was a time that humans could look at a dark skin and not see ugliness or danger, I think that we can create that different time again. But it's going to, again, take us, it's going to cause us to focus on these policies, cause us to focus our efforts on these powerful people who benefit from these racist policies, who keep producing these racist ideas that we're all consuming.
That's University of Florida professor Ibram X. Kendi. He's the author of the book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. And in August, he will join us at American University as professor and founding director of the new Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. Ibram, thank you so much for joining us today on 1A.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. So again, it's a pleasure to be on this show.
Remember, you can connect with us via text message. Text 1A to 63735 to join our network. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until next time, I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute and columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you all so much for listening. This is 1A.